Strong playing you the pop music you love on VOA 1, the hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm Dan Novak. This program is designed for English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, Dan Novak has a report on the problems facing Kenya's Nairobi River and the people who depend on its water. Brian Lynn presents this week's science report. We close with the next part of our U.S. history series. But first, here is Dan Novak.
As the river moves through Kenya's capital, Nairobi, the clear water turns black, and large birds feed on dead animals alongside. The Nairobi River crosses Kibera, a neighborhood of nearly 200,000 poor people. It goes near several factories that make clothes, alcohol, and building materials. Environmentalists have accused them of releasing untreated wastewater and other pollutants like oil, plastic, and glass into the water. Experts and locals fear the water is harming plants in nearby farms that feed many Kenyans. Community groups help clean up the river, and the government is increasing its efforts. But families in the quickly growing suburb of Athi River, some 30 kilometers away, say they can no longer depend on the water. Anne Nduta is a mother of two babies. At times, she uses the river's dark waters to wash her children's clothes by hand. When it rains, the Athi River water is usually full of garbage. When it clears a bit, we use it to wash clothes, said Nduta. But as the dry season continues, the water becomes darker in color, and we have to start buying expensive water. A 20-liter can of water sells for 20 shillings, or 16 cents. Nduta would need four of them to wash her baby's clothes every 3 days. Morris Mutunga grows vegetables like kale, spinach, and amaranth on his farm in the Athi River area. He has watched crops like French beans shrink when he used water from the river. I wish those polluting this river upstream in Nairobi could stop for the sake of food security in our country, he said. The area is the source of many vegetables sold in Nairobi markets. Stephen Obiero is a scientist who studies organisms and the environment. He said that waste in the river used to water farmland could expose plant products to bacteria and viruses. The problems start further up the river. Violet Ahuga says her family defecates in bags and throws them in the river because they cannot pay to use modern toilets. She said, "I know what I'm doing is pollution, but there's no other way because I cannot afford the 850 shilling, about $6.85, monthly toilet fee. Besides, many unofficial housing areas also direct their wastewater lines straight into the river. The settlements have open trenches where people pour dirty water that flows into the river. Kenya's new national government says it is trying to clean up the river. The government has formed a group to clean up and protect the river. But the group has no budget and is yet to meet. The National Environment Management Authority, or NEMA, is responsible for overseeing the river's water quality. Some Kenyan lawmakers have accused the agency of letting industries get away with polluting the river. Research groups have found high levels of heavy metals like lead, barium, iron, aluminum, zinc, and copper along the river. Alex Okaru is a public health expert at the University of Nairobi. Okaru said if people drank the water, high levels of heavy metals could cause health effects such as liver and kidney damage. NEMA Chief David Ongare told the Associated Press that few companies are being charged because the government is working with industries to deal with pollution. He said businesses are asking NEMA for help to follow its rules, and the agency follows all reported incidents of pollution. He added that the agency has also been watching companies with past pollution problems, and he said that if any continue to have problems, action would be taken. Locals and community groups say a way to clean up the river would be to provide modern toilets at little or no cost. In Kibera, an organization called Mazingira Yetu, Swahili for our environment, is working with the government to build 19 modern toilets. The organization's co-founder, Sam Dindi, said they also wanted to prevent plastic and other waste from being dropped in the river. Plastic waste could be reused, and organic waste, Dindi said, could turn into fertilizer. I'm Dan Novak.
A small asteroid was discovered recently, just days before it passed close to Earth. The object was never considered a real threat to our planet. But the discovery has raised questions about whether current systems used to identify possibly threatening objects might leave a blind spot for some objects. NASA and its international partners continuously search the skies for what scientists call near-Earth objects. Such objects include asteroids and comets that come within 50 million kilometers of Earth's orbit. The American Space Agency, NASA, announced January 25th that an asteroid about the size of a large truck would pass very close to Earth the very next day. The agency said the object, called 2023 BU, was expected to make one of the closest trips past Earth ever recorded. NASA said the asteroid was discovered January 21st by an amateur astronomer based in the Russian-occupied Ukrainian territory of Crimea. The astronomer, Gennady Borisov, is a telescope maker and operates his own observatory. He is credited with discovering an interstellar comet in 2019. Additional observations of 2023 BU were then reported to an internationally recognized organization, the Minor Planet Center, which records the current positions of near-Earth objects. The data was added to the Near-Earth Object Confirmation page. NASA said that in the days leading up to the asteroid's flyby, a number of observatories around the world were able to confirm the position of the object. This helped astronomers follow 2023 BU's orbit. Davide Farnocchia is an engineer and planetary defense expert at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory in California. He said in a statement that the agency was quickly able to rule out an asteroid strike. NASA said the asteroid passed within 3,600 kilometers of Earth, above the southern tip of South America. That distance is 10 times closer than numerous satellites orbiting Earth. Scientists said that even if the space rock came a lot closer to Earth, it would have burned up in the atmosphere. In that case, a few bigger pieces might have fallen to Earth as meteorites. In general, NASA believes the probability of Earth being struck by a space rock is very low. Astronomers estimate that a space rock of 5 meters in length targets Earth once a year, and a 50-meter rock is estimated to target Earth once every 1,000 years. But existing systems used to identify near-Earth objects have difficulty finding smaller ones. Asteroid 2023 BU was on the smaller end of a grouping of objects between 5 to 50 meters. Scientists say objects that size are difficult to identify until they get much closer to Earth. This makes it difficult to prepare for an object that might be heading for a populated area. We don't know where most of the asteroids are that can cause local to regional devastation, Tarek Daly told Reuters news agency. He is a planetary scientist at the Johns Hopkins Applied Physics Laboratory in Maryland. Some astronomers have proposed using new tools to identify near-Earth objects rather than depending on probability estimates and existing asteroid populations. Daly noted that new identification tools could help scientists deal with a possibly dangerous asteroid event. How many natural hazards are there that we could actually do something about and prevent for $1 billion? There's not many, he said. NASA is already planning to launch a new infrared space telescope designed to support current planetary defense efforts. The Near-Earth Object Surveyor is currently still in development and is set to launch in 2026. NASA officials have said the telescope promises a major improvement over existing ground-based models limited by daytime light and the effects of Earth's atmosphere. Last year, NASA carried out the first-ever planetary defense test when it crashed a spacecraft into an asteroid. The test successfully changed the path of an asteroid named Dimorphos. I'm Brian Lynn.
Now, Brian Lynn joins me to talk more about this week's science report. Hi, Brian. Thanks for being here.
Sure, Ashley. Thanks for having me.
In your report, we heard about an asteroid that recently passed very close to Earth. We know the American Space Agency, NASA, said it never considered the asteroid a strike threat. But it was not discovered until days before it made its trip past Earth. How did NASA explain this?
Yes, so planetary defense experts at NASA explained that because this particular asteroid was quite small, about the size of a transportation truck, it was not easy to identify with existing Earth-based telescopes. In general, NASA says that such objects are difficult to find until they get much closer to Earth.
And did NASA scientists say anything about possible damage the asteroid would have caused if it actually hit our planet?
Yes, they did address this, but they noted that even if it had headed straight for the planet, it likely would have turned into a fireball and mostly burned up after entering Earth's atmosphere. In this case, some larger parts of the asteroid might have fallen to the surface as small meteorites, but would not have been capable of causing major damage.
Okay, what can you tell us about the new telescope NASA is planning to launch in an effort to identify these kinds of asteroids?
So NASA says the new telescope, which has a launch date of 2026, uses infrared technology and will be based in space. The agency notes that infrared telescopes can pick up much more detail than traditional telescopes. The James Webb Telescope, for example, also uses infrared technology, and we've already gotten a lot of incredible images from that telescope. And since the new telescope will be an orbiting observatory, NASA says it won't have the same data collection limits as ground-based equipment.
Interesting. Well, thanks again, Brian, for joining me today.
You're welcome. Thank you, Ashley.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. In the late 1800s, white Americans expanded their settlements in the western part of the country. They claimed land traditionally used by American Indians. The Indians were hunters, and they struggled to keep control of their hunting lands. The federal government supported the settlers' claims. It fought and won several wars with Indian tribes. It forced the Indians to live on government-controlled reservations. Larry West and Steve Ember tell about the people who settled on the old Indian lands after the wars.
After the Indians were defeated, thousands of settlers hurried west. Some hoped to find new, rich farmland. The soil they left behind was thin and overworked. Their crops were poor. Some simply hoped to buy any kind of farmland. They did not have enough money to buy farmland in the East. Others came from other countries and hoped to build new lives in the United States. All the settlers found it easy to get land in the West. In 1862, Congress had passed the Homestead Act. This law gave every citizen and every foreigner who asked for citizenship the right to claim government land. The law said each man could have 65 hectares. If he built a home on the land and farmed it for 5 years, it would be his. He paid just $10 to record the deal.
Claiming land on the Great Plains was easy. Building a farm there and working it was not so easy. The wide, flat grasslands seemed strange to men who had lived among the hills and forests of the East. Here there were few hills or trees. Without trees, settlers had no wood to build houses. Some built houses partly underground. Others built houses from blocks of earth cut out of the grassland. These houses were dark and dirty. They leaked and became muddy when it rained. There were no fences on the Great Plains, so it was hard to keep animals away from crops.
Settlers in the American West also had a problem faced by many people in the world today. They had little fuel for heating and cooking. With few trees to cut for fuel, they collected whatever they could find. Small woody plants, dried grass, cattle and buffalo wastes. Water was hard to find, too. And although the land seemed rich, it was difficult to prepare for planting. The grass roots were thick and strong. They did not break apart easily. The weather also was a problem. Sometimes months would pass without rain, and the crops would die. Winters were bitterly cold.
Most of the settlers, however, were strong people. They did not expect an easy life. And as time passed, they found solutions to most of the problems of farming on the Great Plains. Railroads were built across the West. They brought wood for homes, wood and coal for fuel. Technology solved many of the problems. New equipment was invented for digging deep wells. Better pumps were built to raise the water to the surface. Some of the pumps used windmills for power.
The fence problem was solved in 1874. That was the year barbed wire was invented. The sharp metal barbs tore the skin of the men who stretched it along fence tops, but they prevented cattle from pushing over the fences and destroying crops. New farm equipment was invented. This included a plow that could break up the grassland of the plains. And farmers learned techniques for farming in dry weather.
Most of the problems on the plains could be solved, but solving them cost money. A farmer could get wood to build his house, but he had to buy the wood and pay the railroad to bring it west. To farm the plains, he needed barbed wire for fences and plows and other new equipment. All these things cost money, so a plains farmer had to grow crops that were in big demand. He usually put all his efforts into producing just one or two crops.
The farmers of the plains did well at first. There was enough rain. Huge crops of wheat and corn were produced. Much of the grain was sold in Europe, and farmers got good prices. The farmers, however, were not satisfied. They were angry about several things. One was the high cost of sending their crops to market. The only way to transport their grain was by railroad, and railroad prices were very high for farm products, higher than for anything else. The railroads also owned the big buildings where grain was stored. Farmers had to pay to keep their grain there until it was sold. They said storage costs were too high.
The farmers were angry about the high cost of borrowing money, too. They opposed the import taxes, tariffs they had to pay on foreign products. Some of the tariffs were as high as 60%. Congress had set the levels high to protect American industry from foreign competition. But farmers said they were the victims of this policy because it increased their costs. Farmers as individuals could do nothing to change the situation. But if they united in a group, they thought, perhaps they could influence government policy.
Farmers began to unite in local, social, and cultural groups called Granges. As more and more farmers joined Granges, the groups began to act on economic problems. Farmers organized cooperatives to buy equipment and supplies in large amounts directly from factories. The cost of goods was lower when bought in large amounts. The Granges also began to organize for political action. Local Granges became part of the national Grange movement. Grange supporters won control of state legislatures in a number of Middle Western states. They passed laws to limit the cost of railroad transportation and crop storage. Railroads refused to obey these laws. They fought the measures in the courts. They did not win. Finally, they appealed to the United States Supreme Court.
The railroads said the laws were not constitutional because they interfered with the right of Congress to control trade between the states. The railroads said states could not control transportation costs. To do so would reduce profits for the railroad. And that would be the same as taking property from the railroad without legal approval. The Supreme Court rejected this argument. In a decision in 1876, the Supreme Court said states had a legal right to control costs of railroad transportation. It said owners of property in which the public has an interest must accept public control for the common good. The farmers seem to have won, but the powerful railroad companies continued to struggle against controls. They reduced some transportation costs, but only after long court fights.
The Granges tried to get Congress to pass laws giving the federal government power to control the railroads. Congress refused to act. Many farmers lost hope that the Granges could force the railroads to make any real cuts in their costs. They began to leave the organization. Others left because the economy had improved. They no longer felt a need to protest. Within a few years, the National Grange had lost most of its members. Some local groups continued to meet, but they took no part in politics. New protest groups would be formed in a few years when farmers once again faced hard times. But for now, in the late 1870s, times were good. Most people were satisfied.
And that's our program for today. Join us again tomorrow to keep learning English through stories from around the world. I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm Dan Novak.